This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng.
Hello. My name is Muhammad Hazim bin Muhammad Zaki. I am 13 years old, going to be 14. I am from Tun right now. My birthday is on 27 December. My weight is 26.7 kilos. My father wakes me at 6:30, something like that, and he shower me because I cannot shower myself. My muscle is weak. I have Duchenne muscular dystrophy. It's an aggressive condition that takes away muscles and cannot function properly. Cannot carry hand, cannot walk, stay on the wheelchair for a long day. My father put me on the wheelchair, and then he carried me to the car, and then we go to the school. When the school, if I want to go to the bathroom, if my father there, I ask my friends to call my father and take me to the bathroom. But if my father already go to the work, I just hold it until the school end at 2:30. On 7:30, until 2:30, I didn't go to the bathroom. Sometimes I ask my friends go call the cleaner to help me. I didn't ask for the teacher to help me because I think my teacher don't know how to help me, want me to be.
Duchenne muscular dystrophy sounds like a mouthful. And if it's the first time you've heard of it, that's no surprise. It's a rare genetic condition that affects only a small percentage of the population. Consultant pediatric neurologist Dr. Koo Teck Beng of Hospital Kuala Lumpur is here to give us the 411 on the condition. He is with Muhammad Hazaki Yusuf, a father of a young boy who recently succumbed to this condition. Welcome.
Thank you.
To start, what is this thing called Duchenne muscular dystrophy?
Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or in short, DMD, is the commonest form of muscular dystrophy. It affects around 3,600 to 6,000 boys worldwide. It results in muscle degenerations and premature death.
That's the number you're giving us. It's a very small number.
Yeah.
Does it warrant looking into?
Individually, it's small, but it has important long-term implication to the families. Many of them, actually, they have a normal intelligence. They go to school, but they face a lot of difficulties. So currently, generally, there is still low awareness among our community. Even doctors, sometimes they are diagnosed late, they are picked up late because of low awareness of this condition.
You give us this number of how rare it is. When compared to other rare diseases, where does it rank?
Duchenne muscular dystrophy is considered a rare disorder. And certainly compared to other form of a childhood disability affecting children, is less common compared to, for example, Down syndrome, autism, or cerebral palsy. But besides Duchenne muscular dystrophy, there are other form of muscle disease as well. So collectively, it's not small.
In the context of Malaysia, what kinds of numbers are we looking at?
We don't have reliable statistics in Malaysia.
Why is that?
In order to have that, you need to have registry. And registry need to be funded. People collecting data, people sending data, and doctors key in information about the patient. And it need to be funded. And to make it sustainable, it need quite a bit of funding. As I mentioned, the awareness is still not there. So there's still maybe the initial effort should be to improve the awareness among the public as well as among the medical professionals.
You think the improvement of awareness will also help with the funding and
hopefully,
the research?
Certainly.
So the numbers, we don't have the numbers in Malaysia.
If we base on the prevalence rate worldwide, conservative estimates, we probably have around 650 children aged between 0 to 14 with this disease.
But they're not at this point identified. How many
are... Many of them are seen in various clinics. For example, in the clinic that I run in my hospital, we have about 40 children with this disorder. And we see about 2 to 3 new cases referred to us every year. That's in my own center alone.
What's the cause of this? Is it called a disease, an illness, a condition? What's the right terminology even?
It's a genetic disorder transmitted through what we call X-linked recessive pattern, whereby the genetic defects is at the X chromosome. Often the boys are affected, the girls are rarely affected, and often the mother may be the carrier and pass the affected gene to the son in about 50%. Another 50% of the daughters will be the carrier, another 50% will be normal.
This is genetic. So folks, if they want to find out I'm a carrier or my child has this potential to be affected by this genetic condition, what kinds of tests are possible?
Currently, not something that we recommend that you do genetic tests to find out whether you have this risk, unless you have family history or unless there are some clinical signs of your child, especially boy, that have some of the features. Because at the moment, we don't screen. It's not recommended you screen for a genetic disease where there's no cure at the moment.
You've already given us a look into the future. At this point, there is no cure.
At the moment, we can say that. But there are many things else we can do.
But we'll come to that. If I were a parent, what do I look out for to say, here is a potential problem? You have mentioned that, you know, if there is a family history, but if the awareness is not there, we might have a condition that is actually that fits right into this genetic disorder, but is totally ignored or is seen as something else.
So, as I mentioned, it's a disease that affects boys. One of the early signs can be a boy that have delayed walking. So, for example, the usual age where we define delayed walking, the child is 18 months. So, by 18 months, if they still doesn't walk, then it's a red flag. We need to consider this condition. So parents need to seek opinion or get tested maybe for this condition.
Now, Zaki, you are the father of a son who recently passed away on account of this disease. When did you first discover that there was something wrong that you took your son for examination?
Well, earlier I didn't realize because to me it's a Duchenne. It's a new word, so it doesn't click what disease is this. I discovered it when he fall down in school.
How old was he then?
He was in standard 2. That is the I look it seriously.
So before that, nothing happened to him, but there are no other signs that there might be something not right.
No, there was a sign of a slow movement. And then he worked very slow and all those things. So we thought that it's normal, I say. It's normal. But then when he fall down, then somebody helped him. And then the second time he fall down, he cannot wake up, really. He cannot...
Cannot get himself off the floor.
Yeah, he can't. This second time is very serious. Then we have to think of the wheelchair. In fact, before that, we went to the hospital, I say. But of course, the doctor said that it's a Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So what is it? We don't know, see. It's a new word. So at the same time, we tried to get the second opinion in other clinics and hospitals. Until we went to the specialist. And then he said that, Asaki, don't waste your time. Don't waste your time. He said that all the specialists in the Institute Pediatric. So we went there. And then we met Dr. Koo, and Dr. Koo assessed it. But even that, we stay a long way to understand it.
Dr. Koo, when you break this kind of news to parents, how do they normally deal with it?
It's really tough. So often we try to assess how much information they already know. Some of them, they already know, yeah. We usually will tell them that this is a disease that's likely to progress. And depending on how much the parents can accept, so we may actually have a few sessions. It may not be just one off. So because sometimes, as probably Inji Hazaki have mentioned, it's tough for parents to accept the
diagnosis.
The diagnosis, the natural history, the likelihood that it will deteriorate with time, and maybe the lot likely to be having a short lifespan. Yeah.
What kinds of tests are being done to diagnose a person who has this kind of condition?
Nowadays, we tend to do genetic tests, which can pick up most cases. So for those children whereby a genetic test failed to pick up the mutation, We need to do a procedure called muscle biopsy, whereby a small piece of the muscle is
You take a sliver of the muscle from where?
From often the what you call the biceps. Yeah. And this will be actually examining under microscope various stainings and looking for the lack of dystrophin, which is the protein which is found lacking in this condition. So that's how we confirm the diagnosis.
I'm talking to Dr. Khoo Teck Beng, a consultant pediatric neurologist, and also with Hazaki, who is the father of a young man who recently passed away on account of this illness. Coming up, how do you tell a young person he has this disease? And how do families take this information? We already know that there is no cure, but what can be done to alleviate this condition? This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
During recess, I'm staying in the class. I didn't go out because I already eat in the morning. My father already gave me some food in the morning. It's hard for me to go to the recess because a lot of people line up and then you're going to push the other people. So that is hard. It's easy for me to walk around the school. My friend push me. But sometimes I don't like people push me because they push where they want to go, but not where I want to go. So that's the problem. I want to put leave for me so easy to go to the lab, science lab, right now, because the government didn't do anything, didn't make the facilities. But my father already write a letter to the government, but they didn't do anything. Since last year until now, they didn't do anything. They didn't leave and all of that. So when my classmate go to the lab, I must stay in the class alone or with my friends till the class end. I haven't been in the science lab. Last year, I have been to the science lab, but people carry me. But it's dangerous. The stairs too high. If I fall down, that's the terrible thing that I cannot imagine. I hope the government put facilities in the school to make the disabled people getting hard to go to school.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. And with me is consultant pediatric neurologist Dr. Khoo Teck Beng and Mr. Muhammad Hazaki Yusuf. Earlier, we spoke about what Duchenne muscular dystrophy is all about. Now we'll find out what's it like living with such a rare condition. We have kind of talked about how parents deal with it and what you have to do to determine whether a child does or does not have. And you've also mentioned that the lifespan of these young people isn't a very long one. Usually by the time you diagnose them in Malaysia, how long do they have?
It actually varies, and also depending on the type of mutation or deletion that the patient has. But it's in a range. Some of them, they die in the teens, but some in the mid-20s. Depending on what support they receive, what treatment they receive as well.
In the context of Malaysia, based on the people that you have seen so far?
Yeah, things has improved. I mean, we're still quite many years in terms of life expectancy of this condition compared to, say, Western country. So maybe in Western countries, the average mean life expectancy maybe in the mid-20s. In Japan, perhaps they are reaching 30s. But many of our children still die in the mid-teens. Looking back, say, 10 years ago, when I ran the clinic of muscle disease with seeing children Duchenne muscular dystrophy, I have not had any children more than 15 years old. That was 10 years ago. Now, some of them, we need to transition them to our adult colleagues, meaning they are in the 20s. But of course, some still die in the teens, depending on, as I mentioned, the complication they have. And what are the other support that they receive in terms of medical treatment? Because not only it affects muscle, it also affects the breathing, the heart, and the spine.
With all these ailments, like the spine, breathing, on that, if we were to look at a person with muscular dystrophy, the word seems to suggest only the muscle shrinking and going away, atrophying. What does this person look like?
Or they look quite normal. Yeah.
Based on...
Except that maybe the muscle is actually wasted. Yeah.
Are they quite skeletal because of the atrophied muscles?
Depending on the stages. For example, at the initial stage, the calf muscle actually is big is hypertrophy, because the disease caused the normal muscle to be replaced by fat and fibrous tissue. It looks big, looks muscular, but only the at the calf muscle. But as time goes by, they become wasted, and they get a lot of these deformities of the limbs.
Zaki, with Hadzim, you had to put him in a wheelchair. At what age did he get into a wheelchair?
Standard 2. That means 8 years old.
I guess where I'm leading to is, what helps are available?
At the moment, we do use certain medications. We use steroid to help to delay this process of deterioration, meaning that we try to prolong the period of ambulation.
Ambulation means moving
walking,
around.
Walking. And it has been shown clinically in many studies to show that steroid may prolong the period of ambulation by 6 months to 2 years, depending on the individual. So this one of the drugs that we usually use. Other things, we will encourage certain type of exercise to prevent certain shortening of the tendon, contractures.
And the shortening of the tendons is caused merely by inactivity. Is that what you're saying? So that's why you give steroids to continue ambulation so that there is movement and therefore they don't become ossified in some ways.
In a way, it does help, but it's not only that. Yeah, because the in the disease process in such a way that the muscle, they are replaced by fat and fibrous tissue, and that itself actually caused the shortening of the tendon and the muscle.
With Hadzim going into a wheelchair in standard 2, so from standard 2 to form 4, right? Was he in form 4?
Yes, four? Yeah. Form 4.
So during that time, what did you have to do for him that he couldn't do for himself?
It's a lot of things, especially when he want to take bath, because he's on the wheelchair, so I have to carry him to the bathroom. So this is a routine job, see? Routine job since he was 8 years old until he passed away. So it's a long process. And initially, it's not that difficult. When he was admitted in 2013 in the hospital for 71 days, that is the starting point where I think it's every 1 hour we have to carry him. Or you have to work on he feel that it's painful at the back, painful here and there, so many things which you can't understand. Yeah. So just make it, just do it.
Here we are talking very much more about problems with ambulation and therefore he cannot get into the shower himself, dress himself perhaps. But you mentioned also with breathing as a problem. What helps are there for that one?
This disease also affects the respiratory muscle. And hence, with time, especially when they stop walking, within a few years, the respiratory muscle will get weaker and weaker. There will be a stage whereby they will start having difficulty in breathing during sleep. So what we do often is that once they become non-ambulant, meaning they are already wheelchair-bound, we actually monitoring them closely, the spine, the respiratory function. And also because it also affects the heart muscle, we also do echocardiography to monitor the contractility of the heart muscles. So depending on what we found, so for example, if a child starts to develop a symptom suggesting that during sleep they have problem in breathing, so then they may need a further test, a sleep study to see whether they need support from respiratory machine, ventilators, or BiPAP machine.
I guess when you have breathing problems and you need these kinds of machines are not readily available, or they are readily available, but they might be not accessible because of the cost.
It's readily available, except cost. But there are ways to get it funded. Getting them properly accessed, I think, is the basic thing. Then usually, for those families who can't afford this breathing machine, respiratory machine, they can be funded through Ministry of Health trust funds, such as a trust fund called Tabung Bantuan Pesakit. If they are government servant, often it can be funded by the JPA.
Medically, in Malaysia, what is done through your clinics, for instance, in terms of, yeah, you have diagnosed somebody, what do you do for this person? I know you say you monitor their heart, their lungs, and all that. And once that's done, I assume they don't stay in the hospital, that you can watch over them, you know, like a guardian angel. but they have to go home, then they have to lead their own lives. What medical support is there beyond the hospital that is done for somebody who has this condition?
Yeah, so depending on the stages of the disease, if they are still walking, so we may prescribe them steroid to try to prolong it. We actually will refer to physiotherapy for them to do some stretching exercise, support them psychologically, and basically a lot of explanation need to be done to the family and the child. When they stop walking, then we monitor the spine, the lung, the heart, and depending on what we found. So usually if a child need a BiPAP machine, so we will discuss with the family. We will actually refer to our specialist colleagues that deal with these issues. And depending on what we detect on the echocardiography of the heart, we may prescribe certain medicine to help in the treatment.
If money were not an issue or resources were not an issue, what more could your clinic be doing? I make it sound as though you're responsible, but I'm not. You know, I'm trying to understand the situation.
Yeah. Managing this condition need a strong collaboration between a few disciplines. Of course, I'm being a neurologist. Usually, we are the lead person. But usually, we have a close collaboration with our specialists who deal with respiratory illness, heart, spines. We refer early for assessment. We help parents to navigate because it's a very complex disease. And at a certain stage, they will have certain complications. We need to deal with it. We actually often, the treatment guidelines is there. Yeah. So we follow international consensus guidelines, how we manage them. Of course, in terms of other support compared to other countries, I think we are quite
insufficient.
Insufficient, yeah.
Where is the lack? Counseling? Where's the lack that you see, Zaki?
There's a lot of things that you have to... like, for instance, my son was recommended to use a BiPAP machine. First instance, when the doctor said that, okay, they have to use the BiPAP machine, and you have to buy the BiPAP machine in order for him to go back. You don't want your son to be in the hospital. But in order to bring him home, you need the BiPAP. And the BiPAP costs very expensive. For my son, it's 34,000. So 34,000.
But Dr. Koo did say that there are ways to get...
Yeah, but then the worker...
The process takes
at least 2-3 months. So you'll be staying in the hospital and
for
then you'll get in all this. So this is the things that the which I mentioned to Dr. Koo to say that we have to shorten the
application process.
Yes. If not, then I think the patient will suffer. I can come up with the money to buy the BiPAP machine. But what about others? So this is the government have to look into this.
Beyond the machine, what else is needed that you think that the medical fraternity somehow cannot quite see because they're not living with that person?
Even you have the machine. Like my experience, if I want to empower the machine with the worker, the oxygen and all those things, so the bill for electricity is around 600 to 700 per month. To power that because
wow.
It's almost doctor recommended. He said, okay, you have to use 24 hours. So 24 hours, if you want to follow the recommendation, then you have to pay for the electricity. So this is the things that the government have to look into it, especially the ministry, the woman, family, and all those things. They are the one who's supposed to come forward and legislate it. I'm not talking about the Duchen alone. All patients which use this machine.
Well, I understand the situation, at least intellectually, and the fact that I've seen your son when he was alive and had a chance to interview him. I'm also aware that because this is a rare disease and it affects a very small number of people, when you live in a country with limited resources, this is always going to be a battle. So somebody like Dr. Koo will have to work with what he's given or can get his hands on. Dr. Koo, how do you juggle these things? When I see him and I see his son, my heart goes out to them. But I try to put myself in the position of the medical fraternity. We have limited resources. What do we do?
Well, we need to deal with it within our what we have. If the child needs a machine, getting the machine, especially if they are assessed and felt that this is the right thing to do, often we can get it, but it takes time. Yeah? What's been mentioned by Inchizaki is very valid. The cost of maintaining it, so electricity bill,
the oxygen,
if they need oxygen, and transportation, sometimes coming to, I do have a family staying in Felda region. So they are staying in wooden house. When they come down from the house, it's difficult, not to say to come to hospital. I do have some patients, when they stop walking, I don't see them anymore because they just can't come.
I know you said there is no cure, but there's medication, so there is some hope. But this picture that you have painted for me, who is an outsider, it doesn't look particularly bright. Is it bright from your side?
We have to be optimistic, but there are many things we can enable the child or and the family to have a better quality of life. So not only we look at the longevity of a child's life, we are trying to see how, as they go along, we help them, support them to better quality of life. In particular, the later stage of the disease, they have a lot of pains. Many of the treatment that we give can be a strong pain relief. Yeah,
alleviate the pain.
Yes. Even, for example, giving them a machine is some sort of palliative treatment to enable them to breathe better, to speak better, and perhaps don't come to hospital so frequent. Because without this machine often, they get frequent chest infection, they may end up to our ward, sometimes in ICU. So if we can get them not coming to hospital and to live as normal as possible at home, and more importantly, if those that can go to school, we must ensure that they continue going to school.
To lead as normal as possible a life.
Yes.
Now, I've heard Hazim say about his experience, talk about his experiences at school. For instance, he's studying downstairs when the lab is upstairs, so he's never been into the lab, even though wants to study science.
Yeah. Actually, the year when he was in Form 1, the school never allocate their classroom downstairs. And it was placed in the inside the what we call the art lab, where you have the table is very high, and he was on the wheelchair, so you can just see the face on it. So it was ongoing for, I think, the 2 months. And then one of the principal at that point of time said, okay, I have a what we call a store. You can convert it into the classroom. But the government doesn't have the money to build it. So I said, okay, you give it to me. And then I turned this store into a classroom with my own expenses. So I built the classroom. I do the tiles. I put it the power. Put the aircon, everything, together with the toilet and the ramp. So the ministry and even the school doesn't give any support on that. So I mean, meaning to say that you have to do it your own. They don't want to know. So that's why Hazim was saying that the government is not doing anything inside this interview. Because he was actually frustrated because of this, and he was never go to the science lab. And I did apply for the leave before he went to that school, 3 years before.
Nothing happened.
The letter was up and down, and called for a meeting. That's a formality just for the statistics and so on and so on. So until today, there's no leave. It's nothing there.
Dr. Koo, how can we make the public become more aware and more importantly, people who are in the service sector, people from the electricity board, everybody, you know, people in schools, how can they be made more aware, therefore it becomes something more real to them rather than something that's talked about but not seen?
Listen to BFM.
We didn't pay you to
say. Well, our community certainly need to be aware that there are people with disability in our community, be it muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy, or other disabilities. Yeah, those able-bodied, we need to advocate for them. Can be parents. For example, there are society that can advocate for this. Among one of the advocate, Malaysian Rare Disorder Society, an NGO that can push forward this advocacy work. Yeah.
Based on my experience with my son, the Women, Family and Community Development Ministry should take the lead to get the committee to work or legislate. You see, it's not only for the Duchenne muscular dystrophy or disease. you have to legislate that the okay, TMB, you have to do your social obligation. Your social obligation is the, let's say, the rate. So that the people are not coming to the what call all the hospital, because now hospital is congested, and they are not doing this. If you go to the school, for instance, like my son's school now, they are not doing anything because they said they don't have the expertise, and then they don't have the budget. So what do you expect? If you are like my son Hazim is very eager to go to school, and he wants to go to the science lab, but he wants to go to the science lab. He said that if he die in the science lab, he want to be there. The first day, they carry Hazim with a wheelchair to the second floor. So this is the what call the woman family. They are the one who issued the OKU card. And again, this ever card, for instance, like Hazim, like, go to the hospital. If you did not bring the photostat copies of the card, then you have to pay.
Even though they can see that he has a specific condition.
Yeah, but this is you have the card. You should do something. And I'm very happy to help all this. And in fact, I started the Housing Foundation to look into this. And I'm willing to work with the ministry to come out and to legislate it so that everybody with all patient can use this.
Do not give up hope. So at the moment, though, we say there's no cure, but there are many things we can do for them, for the child as well as the family. Certainly, there are a lot of research going on, phase 2 trial, phase 3 trial. So we don't know. Within a few years, there may be a new treatment. So we always try to be optimistic and looking forward to those potential treatment.
In your earlier tenure there, you saw teenagers passing away. Now you got some who are in their 20s and moving out. And the hope is that they can be like in Japan where they're in their 30s. I've been speaking with consultant pediatric neurologist Dr. Khoo Teck Beng of the Hospital of Kuala Lumpur about the rare condition known as Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And Muhammad Hazaki Yusuf is the father who recently lost his son. I don't have an answer as to what more should be done, but I wish you all the best, Hazaki, on your setting up this advocacy group and engaging with the government to do more for people who are suffering from this illness. Yeah. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
You've been listening to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
I want to become a physicist. My icon is Albert Einstein because I like him very much. I feel motivated from his quotes, from his work. This is the quote I remember. Life is just like riding a bicycle. If you want balance, you must keep moving.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.